From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Dan Revive, Washington correspondent for I-24 News, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. The United States has pulled out of a nuclear deal with Iran. President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will meet in Singapore on June the 12th, and the nominee to head the Central Intelligence Agency is facing tough questions on Capitol Hill. Gentlemen, no shortage of things to talk about this week. In fact, maybe a historic week by some measures. Let's actually start with Iran. The U.S. has pulled out of the so-called P5 plus one nuclear deal with Iran. Dan Revive, you know the Middle East quite well. Let's start with you. Tell our listeners, why did President Trump do this?
Well, he'd been threatening to do it for a long time. As a candidate for president in 2016, he said that the Iran nuclear deal from the year 2015 was the stupidest deal he'd ever heard of in diplomatic history. A lot of skeptics said, did he really read it? Has he really examined it? Or just something he wanted to say because he likes undoing what the former president, Barack Obama, did? So there's an element of that. And this week, he actually made the decision. The United States will not take part anymore. It doesn't mean the end of that Iran nuclear accord. You know, Iran had agreed to restrict its nuclear activities in exchange for the lifting of economic sanctions. And among other things, a lot of Iranian money was released by the United States. It had been frozen here. A lot of experts say it was about $50 billion. President Trump says it was $150 billion and really stupid to give to them. He can't reverse all of it, but he said the United States won't take part anymore. I just want to mention that he, because a lot of people miss this, in his speech announcing the withdrawal, he did say, we're going to work with our allies toward a wider set of agreements with Iran. What he meant, apparently, is that the U.S. hopes to persuade, especially France, Britain, and Germany, to force Iran back to the negotiating table to negotiate more restrictions.
Well, that's an important point. I mean, some people don't realize, and the president has never really talked about this. He did the other day. Again, it's called the P5 plus one. This is not a bilateral U.S.-Iran thing, as some people seem to think. It's the U.S., France, Britain, Germany, Russia, China, and all of them, Tom DeFrank, have resisted what President Trump has done. Are they going to work with him at this point? I mean, where does it go from here?
Well, I think the Europeans, especially Paul, are just irritated with President Trump. People around President Trump say, oh, that's what they have to say. They'll work with us. But I'm not sure. It remains to be seen. On the other hand, President Trump has no small amount of leverage on the economic side. For instance, the U.S. is going to restore sanctions that were lifted on Americans. Companies doing business, and for instance, the Boeing Corporation, the Boeing Company, has a deal to sell jumbo jets to the Iranian government, actually to Iran Air, for $17 billion. The Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, says that deal is history. That $17 billion is real money, especially when you have Airbus selling Airbus equipment to Iran for $19 billion.
So, but Tom, don't forget, now the U.S. is saying it will try to block the European company Airbus from selling to Iran.
Right, exactly right. That's part of it because transfers of money of that magnitude on the global stage sooner or later come through United States banking entities. And so the Treasury Department here thinks that even the Europeans are going to have trouble doing business with the Iranians if the U.S. doesn't allow them to use U.S. banking, the U.S. banking system. So we will see.
And on that one point, and not to kind of broaden the discussion here, but this sort of plays into the hands of Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, in a way, because you've simply said that this drives a wedge between the U.S. and our North Atlantic allies, our allies in Europe. Could the U.S. actually sanction countries in Europe, our allies, at trying to do business with Iran?
Well, I think if they did that, it would be a real a wedge. Would be an understatement if the U.S. tries to do that. But this, I agree with you, Paul. This does play right into the hands of Vladimir Putin, whose whole MO, and we saw it in the 2016 presidential election, is to try to sow discord among democracies, get them fighting with one another. And his theory is, if we can disrupt other systems of government, especially democratic systems of government, that makes us stronger. So to that extent, it will probably help him.
Let's keep in mind how this appears here in Washington. In the past few weeks, President Trump had visits from the French President Emmanuel Macron and from the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Clearly, they were asking him to stay in the nuclear deal. As a concession to President Trump, they suggested that we can build on it. Let's keep the nuclear deal, but still demand that Iran also talk about its ballistic missile work and its other activities, including alleged support for terrorism groups. And then the British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson also came to Washington. He didn't get to see Trump, but he got to see the Vice President Mike Pence. And the British stand was pretty much the same. So the Europeans were united and then disappointed. And so they say that it still is possible to arrange more talks with Iran, and maybe they can satisfy the United States. This wedge between the allies, we're not there yet. We're close, though. The Europeans say they're disappointed by Trump's decision. By the way, at home here in the U.S., I think White House officials are really, really pleased, certainly when it comes to Trump's base, because he promised them he would walk away from bad international deals. They're really pleased that he had the courage to do that. As Trump likes to say on a lot of topics, nobody thought I would do it, but he did.
The other thing, by the way, is, and I think you mentioned this earlier, Dan, Trump seems to have this pattern of, well, whatever the prior president, Barack Obama, did, I'm going to turn that around. It's not just the Iran nuclear deal. It's the Paris Climate Accord. It's the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this big, vast Pacifica trading scheme. Is it too simplistic to say this is what his strategy is? Just do whatever Obama did and go the opposite way.
It's a big part of it. And don't forget the health care system here, Obamacare. He's happy to have crippled that by taking away key elements. And so he's proud. It builds up his base. You know, when it comes to political analysis, and Tom, this is your thing even more than mine, Trump seems to feel that he wants to strengthen his base, even with key midterm elections to Congress coming up this year in November. And he's not making an effort really to appeal to more voters, appeal certainly to any liberals. No, he continues to reject anything Obama ever did.
I agree with Dan completely. I mean, anybody who listened to President Trump during the campaign would not be surprised by this at all. I mean, he's worried about his base. His base loves him. We'll see in November whether 30 to 35% of the American people being in love with President Trump is enough to keep control of the House in the Republican Party.
Will they come out and vote? That must be a big concern for him. And you know, again, he's not a veteran politician, not at all, but he's got this gut feeling, and apparently he thinks that if we just coast along, folks on his side won't be motivated. And so I think he likes this feeling of a crisis, including pulling out of the Iran deal. That kind of feels like a crisis, but it could motivate his base.
And his instincts have actually, as far as he's concerned, actually played out pretty well. That's how he sees it. And the other thing, Tom, his approval numbers have actually been inching up just a little bit, which in his view validates everything that he's doing.
Exactly right. And it also validates his view that the press is an enemy of the American people, but more specifically an enemy of President Trump. And this allows him to go back and continue to talk about fake news. And that's another key component of whipping up his base, keeping his base galvanized and motivated, and in hopes they'll turn out in November.
Now, sort of ancillary to this, and I think this is a question for you, Dan, right after this announcement that the U.S. was pulling out of this deal, fighting broke out between Iran and Israel. They've been fighting sort of a shadow war, if you will, for a long time. It's come out of the shadows now. Explain sort of the timing of that and what's going on here.
Well, the scene of the battle is the Israel-Syrian frontier. There's, of course, been a civil war in Syria now for more than 7 years, and Iran's been supporting Syria's President Assad. So Iran is there. Iran has Revolutionary Guard troops who are there. And Israel's been concerned for some time, and in recent months they've just found it intolerable. According to the Israelis, Iran is trying to build a permanent presence there and getting closer and closer to the Israeli border. And there was a sense, by the way, that everyone in the Middle East was waiting for Trump's decision on the Iran nuclear accord and waiting for an election in Lebanon, where Iran's allies ended up doing quite well, by the way, the Hezbollah, Shiite Muslim party there. Well, once those two things were over, Trump's decision and the Lebanese election, you're right, the violence broke out. Who shot first? You know, of course, there are arguments about that. But for the first time, there were Iranian rockets fired at Israeli positions in northern Israel and the Golan Heights, captured from Syria by Israel back in 1967. When Israel struck back, they said, 50 targets. They were really showing off the capabilities of the Israeli Air Force. They destroyed some of Syria's air defense system, and they hit a lot of Iranian positions, almost surely killing Iranian Revolutionary Guard members. And so one wonders what's next and how Iran can tolerate this. Israel, of course, is sort of wagging a finger saying, don't challenge us. We are the big military power in the Middle East. And so you're right, it could get out of hand, too. Israeli experts believe that Iran doesn't want a war, that Iran knows it would be outmatched.
Thoughts on that, Tom?
Well, I think that's exactly right. These are two countries who seem viscerally willing to go to war, except I think you're right also, Dan, the Iranians would have the shorter end of the straw on that one. And so I think they're going to continue to provoke Israel, but in a limited sort of way.
All right, let's take a break here. We're going to talk about another big story, North Korea, in just a moment. More Issues in the News after this.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Dan Revive, Washington correspondent for I-24 News. And Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is Paul Brandis, the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. Another giant story. This one is just a stunner, frankly. A sitting American president for the first time will meet with the leader of North Korea, President Trump. Kim Jong-un will meet in Singapore on June the 12th. Wasn't it just a couple of months ago, Tom, that these leaders were threatening to destroy each other? Trump was calling him Rocket Man and Kim using his usual incendiary talk. And now they're going to meet. It's sort of unbelievable.
It is breathtaking. And whatever you think about President Trump and his ideology, you have to, you know, if you're being honest, you have to say this is quite an accomplishment so far. This has never happened. And the North Koreans, I think, clearly want to talk because they have done a couple of things that the United States has said through diplomatic channels would be helpful for progress. For one, they have released three American citizens who had been held in Korea from between 1 and 2.5 years. And they have suspended their nuclear tests, something the United States said that would be a confidence-building measure, which tells me that Kim wants talks. And so this is progress. Whether it means there will be what the White House calls a denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, I'm a little skeptical on that one. I do not believe there's a chance that Kim is going to give up his nuclear arsenal, because that's the one thing that gives him stroke on the world stage.
Well, let's define our terms here. I mean, is that what it means, giving up the nuclear weapons? What about nuclear research? What about their ballistic missiles? What about other weapons of mass destruction that they're believed to have? They have this robust chemical and biological weapons capacity. What about all of that, Dan?
Yet to be defined, but again, the phrase being used is denuclearization. And by the way, North Korea, in its propaganda, has always said that there shouldn't be any nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula. And for many years, what they meant was that the U.S. military shouldn't be there because you don't know what's in the American planes and ships. And at least to my knowledge, the U.S. military, in fact, does not usually declare what's in the ships. But U.S. officials have said, it's not on our plan to have nuclear weapons in South Korea, so let's put the pressure back on North Korea to give up the nuclear weapons. And that's been what President Trump's been talking about in his informal language, to get rid of the nukes, as though pure and simple that's what it is. He's not so concerned about North Korean behavior. He's not complaining about what is often termed as the enslavement of North Koreans at labor camps. In other words, the human rights issues. That's not his thing. He vows to make the world safer. And have you noticed, President Trump, in his tweets and his public remarks, is so optimistic about this. I wonder if he's raising expectations too high, and he is putting Kim Jong-un certainly at his level when he says both of us in Singapore on June 12th, right, the date and location have now been announced, both of us will do something for world peace. I think he's raising expectations, and that can be risky.
Now, we've defined what Trump wants from the North Koreans. What do they want from us?
Well, they're not saying in public, and when it comes to, by the way, gathering intelligence in North Korea, this is from former CIA people who admit that the U.S. does not know much about what goes on in North Korea, because all you really need to know is within kind of a 20-centimeter parameter, which is between the two ears of Kim Jong-un. And so what are you going to do, read his mind? At least Mike Pompeo, who's the new Secretary of State of the U.S., has been there twice in the past 5 weeks as CIA director and then again as Secretary of State. In what a jovial relationship. We all saw the video footage, smiling, chuckling at jokes, being so nice to Kim Jong-un. Wow, talk about unthinkable. So Pompeo must think that he understands what the North Koreans want and what they might give. Of course, classically, we think North Korea wants regime preservation, some sort of promise or guarantee the U.S. and its allies will never invade North Korea, never try to topple the Kim family dynasty. I wonder if President Trump might actually give that guarantee in public. I'm really wondering.
You know, the North Koreans have promised to give up their weapons before 1992. They did. Why should we believe them now?
We shouldn't, except for the fact that what does Kim want for us? He wants some easing of sanctions, because it looks to me like Kim Jong-un realizes that the economic deprivation of his country has reached critical mass. They're having trouble importing stuff, even with the Russians helping on the black market on oil and other things. I think the South Korean president has convinced Kim Jong-un that there is a path towards greater economic stability. Under certain circumstances, the South Koreans would help with that. I think he wants some of that, but is he willing to pay the price that President Trump may demand remains to be seen.
What's the status of these American troops in South Korea, maybe 28,000 troops there? Will they stay?
I think they will stay, but I would suspect, and I've been to Korea many times, the U.S. has built an enormous army base south of Seoul.
Beyond the range of their artillery.
Precisely. Troops. It was built. It's just been open less than a year. I don't know anything, but I suspect that Trump will offer a token withdrawal of American troops.
Which maybe. I'm not sure would bother him. He has said publicly he'd actually like to reduce that number. He considers it
exactly
to be a waste
right.
of money.
And, you know, there was a report recently that Trump has asked the Pentagon to look into a contingency plan for removing some U.S. troops. The White House dismissed it.
That was just a trial balloon.
Well, it's what we used to say at the Pentagon is a non-denial denial. It is a trial balloon. And I'm sure President Trump would be more than willing to have a few thousand of American troops. I think there's 28,000 there now. Come home if that would get him something in a larger deal with the North Koreans.
Quickly, Dan, let me come back to the Middle East just for a second. The United States has attacked Syria twice now. during the Trump presidency. Some analysts say, well, Kim holding on to his nuclear weapons would prevent anything like that from happening. It's his security blanket. Does that seem logical to you for him to give up that security blanket?
No, as Tom suggested earlier, it's hard to believe he'd give up all his nuclear weapons. He devoted, North Korea, devoted a lot of resources, a lot of scientific work, a lot of money, a lot of smuggling to actually build nuclear weapons. That's his guarantee of survival. He'd give up every single one, not even insist on keeping one nuclear bomb in a closet. On the other hand, I can't see President Trump agreeing to that. They're at loggerheads. But sure, by the Middle East history, we notice that Saddam Hussein of Iraq never got to develop a nuclear weapon. We see that Colonel Gaddafi in Libya gave up his nuclear program. And what's with both of them? Overthrown and dead. And Kim Jong-un must have seen that. It's an amazing thought that Kim might give up his nuclear weapons. On the other hand, you're right about the people there starving. Kim wants his preservation, a deal with America, including money, prosperity, but he still gets to run that country. It could appeal to Kim Jong-un.
All right. Well, we're going to be talking about this a lot in the coming weeks, I'm sure. Issue three this week, confirmation hearings are underway for Gina Haspel. She is the president's nominee to head the Central Intelligence Agency, a longtime CIA staffer. She spent her entire career there. But this confirmation is meeting a lot of resistance in the Senate, Tom, over this issue of enhanced interrogation techniques, also known as torture. What's that all about?
Well, it's because this was a very contentious element of U.S. policy when George W. Bush and Dick Cheney were running the country. And it's interesting that former Vice President Cheney has been on Fox News recently saying, I'd bring back torture and waterboarding, a technique that simulates suffocation and drowning. He said, I'd bring them back right now. So the Democrats think that's torture. And Mrs. Haspel said categorically that if she were confirmed a CIA director, she would not bring back enhanced interrogation techniques. And while she was very slippery in her testimony, she said that she would not obey an unlawful order and that at the moment torture is considered unlawful by the U.S. government.
Well, and you remember a key quote from Gina Haspel is, my moral compass is strong. I was raised well by my parents. And if the president, she was asked, gave you an order that you considered immoral, she said she wouldn't carry it out, even if it was technically legal. So she was giving, I thought, the right answers, but everything is partisan these days, so almost all the Democrats don't seem to believe her, and the Republicans, almost all of them, seem to be okay with her and think that Donald Trump should have his choice of CIA director. And so I expect a party-line vote that the Senate Intelligence Committee this coming week will probably approve her. On the floor of the Senate, it's not certain, but the Republicans have a slim majority. I think she'll be confirmed, don't you?
Yes, I do think she will be confirmed, but it'll be very, very narrow. It's interesting that Senator John McCain, who was tortured in Vietnam during 6.5 years of captivity by the North Vietnamese, he will not be back for the vote. He's home in Arizona battling brain cancer, but he has said that he is opposed to her because torture does not work. But I do think there are a couple of Democratic senators, including one from West Virginia, who's very worried about re-election in November. I think there will be a couple of Democratic defections. So I think she will be confirmed. And whatever else you think about her, there's not a lot of evidence, if any, that she is a partisan.
And by the way, she'd be the first female director of the CIA. I think President Trump wants another high-level woman on his national security team, the other being Nikki Haley, the ambassador at the United Nations. And everyone who's worked in the intelligence agencies has said in public, whether they're generally anti-Trump or pro-Trump, that she's a terrific manager. She knows the CIA inside and out. She had a long and apparently good career as an undercover officer. I'm hearing nothing but praise from the intelligence professionals.
Right, and they want one of theirs. They didn't like Secretary of State Pompeo. They thought he was a partisan of the first rank. And whatever else she is not a partisan. So I agree with Dan. I think she will be confirmed.
But you two have highlighted this apparent disconnect where she claims that she would refuse any order that she considered immoral. But President Trump has talked about, he thinks that waterboarding is okay. So what if he says, I want you to waterboard this suspect in Malaysia or something like that that we've captured? What would she do?
She said she'd refuse the order, which means that you then have to resign. And so I'll take her at her word. That's probably what would happen. Therefore, will President Trump actually give that order? How could we know?
So you both think that she's going to be confirmed?
Yes.
Okay. All right, we're going to have to end it right there. Thanks to two of Washington's best journalists, Tom DeFrank of National Journal and Dan Raviv. He's with Israel's I-24 News. This program was produced by the Voice of America Current Affairs, our engineer Justin Thwaites. And I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports. Thank you very much for listening.